Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Through her family's experience with cancer and lawsuits, she had learned that making the connection between cancer and environmental factors is not only possible, it's imperative. It's a quote. Her family was the first American, her father, to successfully sue a cigarette company in a court of law. Joy Horowitz was assigned by Los Angeles Magazine to write a story about the Beverly Hills oil well controversy, and that assignment yielded the book that she will discuss tonight with Judith Lewis, Parts Per Million, The Poisoning of Beverly Hills High School. To write her book, she did extensive research. I'm sure they'll talk about that tonight. She talked to toxicologists, oncologists, epidemiologists, environmental scientists, petroleum engineers. She attended community meetings, city hall meetings, school board meetings. She went the whole distance. I grew up in Los Angeles, and the sight of oil wells behind Little League fields or in other odd places was a commonplace to me. As a child, I thought of them as giant toiling ants who never tired. I never considered what effect they might have on my health or my family's, but Horowitz's book reminds us that the LA Basin sits on a series of oil fields and that California is the largest oil-producing state behind Alaska, Texas, and Louisiana. Joy Horowitz is a freelance journalist and former staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She has a master's in studies of law degree from Yale Law School, and she's been the recipient of a Ford Foundation Fellowship, a Pulitzer Prize nomination, for her reporting on indoor air pollution for the LA Times, and a Sunday Magazine Editors Association Award for her LA Times Magazine article, Greetings from Pearly and Tessie, which was the basis for her 1996 book. And in conversation with her tonight is Judith Lewis, a senior editor at LA Weekly, where her writing on technology, the arts, natural resource issues, public health, and the environment has appeared since 1991. Judith last interviewed Richard Preston for us on climbing the giant redwoods, and she did a wonderful job. Her work also appears in High Country News, Wired, Sierra Magazine, and the LA Times. And she's won an Association of Alternative Newsweeklies Award for her reporting on nuclear power and global warming. She's a member of the Society for Environmental Journalists and is currently at work on A Layperson's Guide to Nuclear Energy. So Joy and Judith will be talking about the book and about the subject, The Poisoning of Beverly Hills High School. Then they will open up to questions from you, the audience. Justin will be carrying a microphone around because we do record for future podcast. We ask that you wait until the microphone comes around. And after the program, Joy will be signing her book in the lobby. And books tonight are courtesy of the library store, and the sales go to benefit this program. So we thank you for patronizing the library store. Now please welcome Joy Horowitz and Judith Lewis.
I imagine that a lot of people here already have a pretty good idea what your book is about, but let's just start out sort of giving a synopsis of it. It really explores the possibility that the exposure to petroleum and the chemicals involved in extracting petroleum from the earth caused a cancer cluster among the students and alumni of Beverly Hills High, where oil fields, I understand, earn $1 million a year for the city.
It's more like closer to $500,000 for the city, $500,000 for the school district, although it's wavered depending on how much is produced there over the years.
Right.
Yeah.
And you describe yourself in your introduction as at first deeply skeptical of these claims. And you call yourself an unlikely chronicler of the school's environmental problems. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to reporting the story and came around in the course of your research to, I assume, you know, feeling differently about the claims and also, you know, how your personal opinion changed?
Yeah, sure. The first thing that I want to say is that I'm not here to support the view that, in fact, there is an absolute link between these 400 or so cancers among graduates and teachers and residents of Beverly Hills and the production of oil and the emissions from the power plant next door to the high school. I honestly think that that's a question that perhaps time will tell in terms of how science works over time. But I was skeptical, I think, like a lot of people in the community, because of how this came to the fore. That is, that in the course of a sort of alarming local news broadcast in which a guy named Drew Griffin, who is now at CNN, at that time was at KCBS, did a report sort of along with the environmental champion, Aaron Brockovich, who at that point was working as a consultant for the Masri Vittito law firm. And she had met a young graduate named Lori Moss, who by age 27 had had both Hodgkin's disease and thyroid cancer. And so from that meeting, there sort of mushroomed this group of students, who young students, who had what seemed to be the same kinds of cancer, that is thyroid cancer, Hodgkin's disease, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it mushroomed. And the community generally was terribly hostile to Erin Brockovich's claims, suggesting that her data was non-existent. But then what happened over the course of time was I became sort of obsessed with trying to get public documents that existed from the Air Quality Management District, from the City of Beverly Hills, from the State Department of Health Services, from the court record once this litigation was underway. There's now pending in Los Angeles Superior Court 8 cases that have been consolidated, and 12 of the 1,065 claims were litigated and dismissed by the judge because he said there lack medical causation or enough evidence to show medical causation between these 6 forms of cancer and the emissions from these facilities. So anyway, over time, what occurred to me was that even though the City of Beverly Hills and the school district were forced into this sort of defensive posture, they were also really misinforming, I thought, the citizenry. That is, there was some pretty serious leaks that were coming out of the Venico facility in the spring of 2003 to the tune of like 915 parts per million of benzene from a non-functioning amine unit. And the AQMD, in fact, shut the facility down at that point. But then the AQMD started doing some things that were also equally questionable in my mind. That is, they were going out and taking air sampling when the facility was shut down or when the facility was only producing oil and not gas. So it was what was being stated publicly wasn't exactly what was on record. And then furthermore, I discovered that as other people who were learning about this in the community, that the wells are, they use radioactive iodine 131 to check for leaks in the wells. And it just strikes me that having 19 functioning oil wells right on a high school football field and within close proximity to the power plant that provides the heating and cooling for Century City next door is just not a great idea. So it was sort of with that premise in mind that I then kind of was tagging along after what were basically the dissidents in Beverly Hills, a group of mothers who were really trying to get some straight answers about whether their kids were safe or not at the school presently. And the issue about what was going on presently, of course, is different from what happened historically. When I was there, for example, because the power plant went in 1965, and up until 1989, the plant had been using a chemical called hexavalent chromium to clean out the cooling towers there. And so that is no longer the case. But
It's interesting. I should point out that the AQMD is the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which up until a certain point in history, I think we trusted to measure our air quality and give us precise figures about that. And that has changed somewhat. In the 90s, it became unclear whether they were caving a little bit too much to industry or not. So just for context.
Well, the Scientific Advisory Board quit, I think, in 1996 in protest of exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some really good people who work for the AQMD, but that's one of the criticisms, is that they are very pro-industry. Of course, I think Barry Wallerstein, who is the chairman of, or the, I don't know what his title is, the director of AQMD, would dispute that, but yeah.
And he also went to Beverly Hills High School.
He was in my class, Beverly High, yep.
Mm-hmm. When these chemicals are being measured, it's not really a question of whether benzene is leaking from the Vinoco plant or whether iodine-131, which is a known carcinogen and causes thyroid cancer. The reason you take potassium iodide when there's some sort of nuclear leak is that it fills your thyroid with iodine, and then the iodine-131 can't get in, and you'll lessen the risk of thyroid cancer. So it's not really a question of whether these were being emitted, because several times in the book they establish that yes, you know, there is benzene, there is hexavalent chromium, there is iodine-131.
Right.
But whether or not they were at a limit that was safe or not, is there a safe level of iodine-131 that a human can absorb, that's okay. Do you question that, whether there's a... At one point you quote Dan Hirsch, who's an anti-nuclear activist, saying there is no level of radiation that's actually acceptable. And is that the same is true for some of these chemicals?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that for the carcinogens, like, for example, benzene and hexavalent chromium and certainly I-131. I-131 has a half-life of 8 days. The issue isn't really what gets measured in the air so much as what your body absorbs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the same with the chemical issue, which is what is your exposure over time? I mean, for example, teachers, there's a lot of people at Beverly Hills High School who have been there for decades. So one would assume that the teachers' exposures would be greater than the kids who were there for only 4 years. In fact, when I interviewed my honors English teacher from ninth grade, who was part of this lawsuit, Louis Versace, he made reference to the curse of the English department, because there were many English teachers, including the former chair of the department for years and years, who wound up non-smokers who ended up getting lung cancer. And there is, in fact, an association between hexavalent chromium being inhaled and lung cancer. The issue is, you know, how much? And that's what happened basically in court that had the case thrown out. It was the position of the defense lawyers representing the oil companies and the plant that, okay, it is true that there were these chemicals being admitted, but they were so minuscule as to be totally inconsequential. On the other hand, you know, the federal government recently has recognized that cancer risk assessments need to be created specifically for children, because they're so much more susceptible than adults.
There's also some evidence that kids who played on the athletic fields were disproportionately affected by whatever toxins were coming out of the oil fields. And there are scenes in the book where students are saying, oh, the fumes were so bad I passed out, I nearly passed out, or, you know, the way the wind was blowing, I couldn't breathe. Isn't it, and I know you're not coming down on one side or another, but it's almost impossible to read scenes like that and not conclude, at least emotionally, that it's axiomatic that, of course, it's a health risk to have an oil field so close to a high school.
Well, there's no question that it's a risk. It's an added risk, but there's a lot of risks that we expose ourselves to over time. And so, you know, the question is this an acceptable risk? And at the moment, anyway, in the city of Beverly Hills, the school district and the city feel, yes, that it is an acceptable risk to have this thing operating 24/7. And part of the reason why it's an acceptable risk, in my opinion, is because both the school district and the city make money from it. And we're talking about a public high school that has had a stellar reputation. I mean, I thought it was a fantastic place, and it still is. And, you know, public education in the state of California is not funded like it should be. So I absolutely understand, but it's a Faustian bargain that's going on.
And one of the calculations in acceptable risk is affected by, you cite a decision that was made about the Occupational Safety and Health Administration in 1980 that made a cost-benefit analysis between economic hardship and public health. Did that play heavily into this decision about what's an acceptable risk at Beverly Hills High, that kind of thinking that was established in 1980 when that decision came down?
Are you talking about the Supreme Court Benzene decision?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Supreme Court Benzene decision, yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I think that my opinion is that the pendulum has swung too far over in the domain of, you know, rather than our trying to protect children and public health,
mm-hmm.
we're really protecting the bottom line. And I think Beverly Hills is, of course, the perfect symbol of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's sort of what the Supreme Court was saying in terms of weighing risks and requiring that OSHA and now EPA, in terms of a lot of toxic chemicals, you have to prove that they're harmful rather than expecting manufacturers and industry to prove that they're safe before they're on the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, to my way of thinking, backwards.
Right. That was a revelation to me that kind of shift in thinking had happened really that recently. You know, a quarter of a century ago, we decided that we were going to start weighing, you know, the health risks against whether it would cause an economic hardship
mm-hmm.
to reduce the health risks. And we see that at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach right now, where they say, okay, 2,400 people a year die from breathing in the air at the ports, and that's so far been an acceptable risk. So in a way, your story at Beverly Hills High is a microcosm of a lot of that other stuff that's going around in the state and in the country.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and we hope it will change and there'll be a different way of thinking about it.
Well, you know, I think that last year, maybe it was two summers ago, Congress, I think it was Lautenberg and Kennedy, introduced a bill in the Senate which would revisit the toxic chemicals are regulated basically by the Toxic Substance Control Act, which was passed in 1976, 77. So 30 years is a long time I think it's, you know, the point of their legislation anyway was to revisit it and to look at it in light of new science that we know a lot more about and what we can do in terms of protecting kids' health. So that's a possibility, but I wouldn't bet on it right now with what Congress is doing.
There was also another decision in 1980 about Superfund that would exempt petroleum that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting in your book how much you run up against the petroleum industry. And, you know, it was shocking to me that Vinoco was promoting Toyota Priuses in a campaign to improve its image at the same time that there were toxic releases coming out of its operations at Beverly Hills High.
Well, by the way, they pronounce it Venico, not Vinoco.
Oh, Venico,
yeah,
okay.
Venico. But you know, yeah, the guy who is the one of the vice presidents of Venico, who is a PR man there, who's in the book, Mike Edwards, who's a very nice guy, they always are. Yeah, he gives tours of the Santa Barbara. He takes people out in a boat. And goes to, like, I think the Santa Barbara County Fair and sort of recruits people to look at how beautiful the sea life is out by the offshore wells, the platforms, mm-hmm. that Venoco runs. So a hybrid car is, you know, that's nothing. But Venoco, the people up in Carpinteria really like Venoco because they created a Little League field up there and helped pay for the Avocado Festival and have done a lot in terms of, I think, the art world in Santa Barbara is also supported by Venoco. Mm-hmm.
They have a presence in Ojai, too.
In Ojai?
Yeah. Where there's a lot of oil, interestingly enough. And speaking of, I think a lot of people would be surprised, if you haven't grown up in Los Angeles, that, as you say in the book, the story of Los Angeles is in part the story of oil. Mm-hmm. That there's so much oil, and there's so much oil under Beverly Hills, and this is part of our legacy. And I think, in a way, our civic leaders and the people who established the city have done a really good job of keeping that hidden and keeping that a secret from the people who live here.
Well, I mean, one of the ways in which it's been hidden was by, you know, it was a law created by the city of Los Angeles in the 1950s that if you're going to have operating oil wells in the confines of the city of Los Angeles, they had to be camouflaged, they had to be masked. So that's part of how that happened. Beverly Hills is kind of a little bit schizophrenic this way, though, because they recently passed an ordinance which bans smoking publicly or in public places in the city. But they also have an ordinance which outlaws drilling in the city of Beverly Hills except at Beverly Hills High School. Mm-hmm. So it's this, you know.
There are a lot of ironies.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the community a little bit. And in your book, it emerges that a good portion of the community was very resistant to examining this at all. And part of the resistance came from that sense of civic pride, right? And that sense of belief and faith in that you were living in a fantasy land in one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Well, it is one of the most beautiful places mm-hmm. in the world. I mean, it's an amazing town. You know, if you need if you're in trouble, you call the police and they're there in 2 minutes. And you need an ambulance and they're there in 2 minutes. And the school district is phenomenal. It's got tremendous support, and it's an interesting mix of people. I mean, I think that 60% of the residents of Beverly Hills are renters, so that the kind of stereotype of this, you know, very wealthy community, while partly true, isn't entirely true. You know, as somebody who grew up in Beverly Hills, I think it's a wonderful place, and that's part of the reason why how the community responded to the revelations about what was going on in terms of these two industrial sites there. It was shocking to me, actually.
Did the lawsuit help or hurt the kind of community, the community's willingness to examine what was going on?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that because it sort of split the community in half. You know, there were parents whose young children or you know, adult children got really sick. And for those people who were not touched by that, they felt that the lawsuit was completely bogus, and that it was, you know, plaintiff's attorneys who were out to make money, and Erin Brockovich out to publicize herself, and so on. And so I'm not sure, frankly, whether the school district and the city, if they weren't in lawsuit mode, whether they would have responded differently or not. Mm-hmm. They were stuck. But I also felt that they, just in terms of providing information to the community, there was so much attention being paid to demolishing the credibility, for example, of Erin Brockovich, rather than actually giving information to the public, which they could have had and sort of digested on. But I mean, to this day, what's amazing to me is that public discussions seem to focus on the wells, which is fine, but there's also this extraordinarily large amount of pollution that's coming out of the plant next door. And if you call up over there, they tell you that it's steam, like coming from a steam kettle.
That's the Sempra.
The Sempra plant, yeah, which was just sold, I guess, last year to another company, but Sempra has been the parent company for years and years. Yeah.
There is also some kind of a cultural rift in the community as well. You mentioned that 50% of the students who go to Beverly Hills High School speak Farsi at home,
mm-hmm.
and they're the children of immigrants from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, you also talk about how those were really the people, along with Jody Kleinman, who emerges as a very powerful character, those are the people who led the activism and the community activism, which is separate from the lawsuit, kind of distancing from the lawsuit, but also saying, why should we take this risk? Let's shut this down.
Right.
Did that make it difficult for the community to unite around it, around this issue?
Absolutely. I think that's part of the reason why the issue never really gained traction. Hmm. I think that there's this great antipathy in Beverly, and it's not just Beverly Hills, but I think it's one out of every five residents in the town is Iranian. And so there is this kind of split in the community. It's changing, certainly. I mean, the mayor of Beverly Hills now is this guy, Jimmy Delshad, who was elected in 2003. So I think that in terms of civic participation, you're going to end up seeing more people involved. But when the ballot recently came out in Farsi, people went nuts in Beverly Hills. It just really annoyed them. So...
I remember that.
You think that's funny? Okay, well.
Also, another thing that got in the way of community participation, and this shocked me, was that there is a legacy of lawsuits against people for taking part in any kind of public resistance to or public participation, these SLAPP lawsuits.
Oh, yeah, SLAPP lawsuits. A strategic lawsuit against public participation, that's what they're called. And I think the California Supreme Court has banned them, essentially, and a lot of legal scholars have written about this, but they kind of, SLAPP suits had their genesis, weirdly, in Beverly Hills in the 1970s, when the League of Women Voters, and I think there was a guy named Irwin Okun, who was a beloved member of the community, who was a PR guy at Disney, actually, and he was... he wrote a letter to the local newspaper criticizing the mayor. There was a land swap deal with the industrial section of the town. And the developer sued him for libel and shut him up. And he ended up having to pay just an enormous amount of money in attorney's fees. He ended up winning, and the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court and came back, and they won. But democracy... in Beverly Hills, I think took a bad turn as a result. It kind of shut people up. So if you live in the town and you want to criticize developers, for example, it's not easy.
Yeah, it's the problem with a lawsuit like that is you don't, even if you win, you don't win. All that time you've spent fighting that is really sucked out of your life.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about the cover, if you want to hold up the book and... here's the cover of the book, and the emblem, the shield of Beverly Hills, is prominently displayed on there. Was that difficult for you to get them to let you
use that? Oh, well, the city of Beverly Hills sent me one of their, you know, they sicked one of their lawyers. I'm trying to remember which law firm it was that was representing them at that point. But anyway, I think it's kind of a formality. But see, the shield of Beverly Hills is on here, and so the city was... angry and wrote me a nasty letter, wrote a nasty letter to my publisher saying that this was trademark infringement and how dare I, and we couldn't publish the book with the shield on the cover. And but my publisher or a lawyer for the publisher wrote back and saying, you know, come on, First Amendment trumps trademark infringement. And I think there was a case law involving Barbie and Mattel. I think somebody had written a book about Barbie, and they put her on the cover without Mattel's permission and was allowed to do it. So, you know. Mm.
And if
the
they
Beverly
could beat,
Hills shield and Barbie. You know?
Okay. If they could beat Mattel,
icons.
They could beat Beverly Hills.
Yeah, yeah.
Mattel's tough about that.
Yeah.
sort of thing. So at this point, maybe you want to read a little bit from the book. You selected something that is about one of the activists in the community who was trying to collect signatures and sort of describes, I think, what people in the community were going through while this struggle was going on.
Okay,
to shed light
I'm just
on
wondering,
it.
Is Masheed here tonight? She told me she was coming, but maybe... Oh, hi, Masheed. Okay, you know, because of Judith, I just want you to know I'm going to read a passage about you. Masheed was one of the moms in Beverly Hills who allowed me to spend time with her in her attempts to close down the oil well, and she worked so hard and tirelessly, and so as well as Jody Kleiman and others, but this is about Masheed. Masheed Soleimani stood alone in the dark, waiting beneath the crescent moon. It was nearly 7:30 on Wednesday evening, September 24, 2003. She was stationed on South Elm Drive in front of Beverly Vista Elementary School. Inside, it was back to school night at BV, and the lights from the classrooms made sharp yellow rectangles on the sidewalk. The street was quiet, but in a few moments, the parents now inside, listening to their children's teachers tell them about the upcoming school year, would pour out of the red brick building. Soleimani waited stolidly behind a folding table she had lugged from her black Lexus SUV, the one with the personalized license plate in honor of her boys, Justin, Brandon, and Jonathan, that read, "I heart JBJ." She clutched a clipboard and a Bic pen to gather signatures for a petition drive to shut down the oil wells at the high school. Her flashing green eyes were intent. She saw this as her last chance to keep the issue alive. Behind her, there were two signs tacked to a chain-link fence. One read, "Respect each other." The other said, "Responsibility starts with me." At last, parents began spilling out onto the sidewalk. "Parents petition to shut the oil well?" she asked politely. It was her mantra on this evening. Sometimes she would pronounce her W as a V, as in oil wells or Vestwood. There was a slightly Zsa-Zsa-esque quality about her, by turns fetching and little girlish, especially the voice. She had learned English by watching TV when she arrived in America with a degree in management and accounting from Tehran University. She wore a black leather jacket, blue jeans, and a stylish black suede boots. Most hurried by without making eye contact. Others stopped and conversed in Farsi, their native tongue. Still others were confused. They thought the wells had been shut down already, and she informed them that they were back up and running again because the local government agencies had given the all clear. "Parents petitioned to shut the oil well?" she asked again. She had already secured more than 100 names when people arrived 2 hours earlier. She was determined to present 2,000 signatures to the city council, and she wouldn't stop until she got them. "Get a life," an angry father sniffed, walking away. "Learn English," another muttered. The antagonism was palpable, not only because she was viewed as a dissident in a town that tended to avoid politics, but she was Iranian-born. The antipathy was mutual, especially when the American-born PTA president scrambled by. "Those son-of-a-bitch PTA moms," Soleimani said under her breath. "They're afraid to sign it and have their names revealed. The fact that I'm a Persian woman makes me less intelligent in their eyes. I'll prove them wrong." The divide between those who signed the petition and those who did not had everything to do with being of Persian descent. Since the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and the fall of the Shah of Iran, the influx of Iranians to Beverly Hills had created deep rifts in the community. Never mind that most of the Persians, like Soleimani, were also Jewish in a town that had long been predominantly Jewish. Beverly Hills, in fact, was originally settled by European Jews in the 1920s in response to restrictive covenants that forbade them from buying property in nearby Hancock Park. When Persians migrated to Beverly Hills, the wealthiest came with suitcases full of cash and bought property. Some raised European revival homes built with Tuscan and Mediterranean influences and colors and erected towering white flat front mansions with imposing columns that the locals disdainfully called Persian palaces. The town's changes have not come without tensions and some resentment. In recent years, controversies have erupted in public meetings over the abundance of Persian palaces and whether it would be appropriate to have a taste czar dictating questions of architectural style. Some of the town's most progressive stalwarts admitted to their discriminatory attitudes. "I can't stand the brown lipstick," one of the locals sniffed. In mixed company, Canadian had become code for Persian. Longtime residents told me they didn't trust their Iranian neighbors because they returned clothing to Saks Fifth Avenue having worn it to an event. Stereotyping runs rampant. Persians are depicted as a shallow, overindulged, and insular group that distrusts public institutions and is plagued by language problems and apathy, refusing to assimilate. Perhaps in response to the criticism, a local businessman named Jimmy Delshad was elected to the city council in the spring of 2003, the first time an Iranian was voted into local office. The most serious tempest erupted in March 2003 when a parent named Abraham Asil opposed the school board's plan to allow the city's consultant, CDM, to conduct environmental testing at the high school. He wanted an independent contractor instead. His pleas and those of other Persian families to the school board led some to brand the oil well imbroglio a Persian issue. The town's deep divide, though largely unspoken, helped to explain why the oil well crisis failed to gain political traction outside the community. Environmental justice in Beverly Hills was like a Rorschach test on how one felt about Iran. If this were a ghetto school, a longtime resident caustically observed, the political implications would be too great to ignore. Here, we're only killing Persians, so it's okay. Masheed Soleimani was fighting that perception. She had met her husband, Taraj, on a blind date arranged by cousins. They first lived in Modesto when he started his cardiology practice, then moved to Beverly Hills in 1989. They spoke in Farsi at home to their sons, who answered in English. Her husbands and boys had grown tired of her crusade and how it had taken her away from them. She hated to think about the fact that Jonathan, now a sophomore at UC Berkeley, had been at the high school for 4 years, and that Brandon, her middle son, had been there since sixth grade as part of a weekly program for gifted students. They had looked into other schools, Malibu High, Palisades High, and had applied to Harvard Westlake, the private school over the hill where many doctors' children from Beverly Hills attended school. But Justin wasn't accepted. She approached another parent for his signature. "You don't believe the crap of the lawyers, do you?" he asked her. Patiently, she explained how her position was different from Ed Masri's. She didn't think there was enough evidence to prove the cancers were caused by environmental factors, but as parents of current students, she and her friends didn't need to wait for their kids to become guinea pigs 10 or 20 years from now, and, oh, by the way, they were right, the rate of cancer at the school is higher than anywhere else. Then she told him that the school district currently made about $350,000 a year from royalties on the wells. "It can't be worth risking kids' life for $350,000, he said, adding his name to the list. Another signature. "Salom," she said to him. "Like shalom in Hebrew, it means peace." She stood in the dark, waiting. She'd need massive patience to do what had to be done again and again. Progress came in tiny steps. "In America," she said, "you're raised to believe this is a land of law. Everything is regulated. It's a democracy. But in Iran, that is not how things work. We were born and raised in a country ruled by a dictator. If the son of a Shah or his brother wanted to do anything, he could get away with it. In America, things are different. Am I naive to be so optimistic?"
I think that really resonated with that will resonate with a lot of readers, but that really resonated with me, that am I naive to believe that the system that we've put in place will keep us safe? And one of the things that you talk about, I have a quote, "Writing a book about toxins in the environment is really an exercise in confronting a series of obstacles. And one of those obstacles was getting access to accurate information." Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, one of the first things that I did when I started working on this book, first a magazine piece and then it, you know, mushroomed into being a book, was file Freedom of Information Act requests. First, for example, with the City of Beverly Hills. I wanted to get detailed information about financial doings, and I also wanted to find out, if I could, when the city had first been informed about troubles at the oil wells. So anyway, I did get some stuff, but the key stuff that I really wanted was denied me by the city attorney, who said that the information was privileged, that it was, you know, protected by attorney-client confidentiality because of the litigation. So getting back to your other question, was getting information because of the lawsuit, getting hold of information became quite difficult. On the other hand, there was a lot of information that you can get out of the court record, and so without the lawsuit, there were a lot of people who did some really important work, I think, in terms of trying to measure historical exposures, for example.
Weren't you also denied some information because of the post-9/11 environment?
Yeah, that was from the State Department of Health Services. I was trying to get the information about the licensees. It's sort of a schizophrenic regulatory thing that we have going in California, where we're supposedly protected by the State Department of Health Services in terms of licensing companies to oversee the use of radioactive materials, and also the local county health department. But I found out that our local county health department here in Los Angeles had no idea that I-131 was being used at oil wells. But anyway, when I filed my request with DHS, it was denied. They said, because it would, in light of Homeland Security and 9/11, it might jeopardize the public interest in Homeland Security. So I tried again a second time. I tried to, you know, narrow down my request, thinking that that might be useful for the people up in Sacramento, and it clearly wasn't, and they sent me basically the same letter again. And then I thought, well, you know, you have to make a decision as a journalist at that point. You know, you can try to fight it and file a lawsuit, and or not, because for me to try to sue the state of California and the city of Beverly Hills would have resulted in, you know, I already was way overdue on my deadline for my book anyway. I mean, the original contract said that it was supposed to be in 2005, and so I finally made a decision that I wasn't going to go there. So
on top of that, negotiating the tangle of agencies that are responsible for air quality or public health, or there's AQMD, there's the Air Resources Board,
right,
there's the State Department of Health Services, that must have been mind-boggling to try and wade through all that and find out where the information really was that you needed.
Yeah, you know, I think that one agency that was the most disappointing to me, frankly, was the local county cancer registry. Because they had been, there's a woman there, an epidemiologist named Wendy Kozin, who had been asked by Jody Kleiman, a parent who you made reference to, who was trying to get information about how safe her kid was at her school. And she wanted an epidemiological study to look at students at the school. And Wendy Kozin did a report in which she said that the oil wells essentially gave the oil wells a clean bill of health. But her report did say that young men in Beverly Hills, I think it was like ages 14 to 44, were at a threefold increase for getting thyroid cancer. Residents of Beverly Hills, not alumni of the school. But she said in her report that those findings were not statistically significant, and therefore she downplayed the importance of it. But what was deeply upsetting to me was to discover that Wendy Kozin's husband, a well-respected researcher also named Tom Mack, at the time was working as a consultant for one of the defendant oil companies in the lawsuit. So to my way of thinking, there was this tremendous conflict of interest going on. But meanwhile, because she came out with this report, the presumption by the local county health department and by the state health services department was that there wasn't a problem. And so the people in Beverly Hills were led to believe the same thing.
And once that research is done and those conclusions are made, that's the end of it. You don't
Well, no. Unless, you know, unless Arnold Schwarzenegger decides, he gets a call from somebody in Beverly Hills and says, you have to look into this, and then he calls his people, you know, at DHS in Sacramento. But otherwise, I don't think, yeah, I think that mm-hmm. that's it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that conflict of interest obvious? Doesn't it jump out at somebody and say, oh my God, this person should not be, should recuse himself from this case, or?
Well, what Mac did was, when this was reported in a little correction in the Los Angeles Times, he apologized, and he said he was going to take any money from the law firm that had hired him. So that was the extent of it.
Back to your deadline that you missed on this book, and that, with good reason. You really were in a position of having to write this story before it was done. The last cases were just dismissed in December of 2006.
Right.
And there was some decision that was made in January of 2007, and here the book is in July of 2007, fully finished.
Right.
How did you manage that?
Well, you can ask my husband. Much stress and duress trying to get it in. You know, I had to write an afterword. I kept waiting and waiting and waiting, thinking that there was going to be this trial that I was going to be able to write about for the last chapter of the book. Mm-hmm. And so the afterword was written basically in December. So I did have the bulk of the book completed by pretty much by last fall.
Mm. And the trial never happened.
Well, the trial, it may yet happen. I mean, no, it didn't. The case was dismissed by Judge Mortimer of Los Angeles Superior Court. He dismissed the first 12 of 1,065 cases. And those 12 cases were bellwether cases of six different kinds of cancers. They were the largest numbers of cases. Most of the plaintiffs, if you broke it down, had certain kinds of cancers. So they included thyroid cancer and Hodgkin's disease and melanoma and testicular cancer and so on. But it turns out that proving medical causation for some of the other cases, in fact, could have been easier. I mean, for example, leukemia, medically, there is a link in the medical literature between leukemia and benzene exposure, and or, as I mentioned earlier, lung cancer and hexavalent chromium. So, and those cases are, we don't know. The case is being appealed by the plaintiff's lawyers, and I don't know what's going to happen.
There's some place in the book where you mentioned nine girls at the high school who all had thyroid cancer.
Oh, they were all on the same soccer team.
And they were in the same soccer team.
Yeah.
And does that figure in as evidence in any of these cases, or will it in the future?
No. Those cases are not part of the...
Yeah. And that doesn't come up.
In fact, I interviewed one of the now young women who was on that team, and she just felt like a lot of other people, that this case was bogus, and she wanted to get on with her life, and she wasn't interested in pursuing it.
Yeah. And isn't kind of the only way to get thyroid cancer from exposure to radiation?
Yeah, that's my understanding, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I finished the book convinced that there's a serious problem, and, you know, I think other people will too.
I mean, I think if nothing else, the most serious problem is the lack of information for people who have their kids at that school and who are in the community, and, you know, that's part of the point of the book, is that it's almost as if there's a public right not to know what's going on. And it's not just Beverly Hills, by the way. I mean, I think that this is true in a lot of other communities across the country. Mm-hmm. But people, I hope, will pay attention because it's Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm. You've collected a really copious amount of information in this book for an environmental reporter. And it's almost like a source book for environmental journalism in a lot of ways, if you're reporting on environmental cancer, and which I think people are starting to realize a lot more with PDBEs in the environment, mm-hmm. And just, you know, the link that they've now shown between particulate matter, which is the soot from diesel engines, mm-hmm. and lung cancer, that a lot of cancers do have an environmental cause. But it's really difficult to prove a cancer cluster right?
Yeah, and if not impossible, because of the, you know, Texas sharpshooter fallacy, for example, which is, you know, it's about statistics, and if you throw a bunch of marbles up in the air, they're going to land in the same place over a certain number. So the same goes for cancer clusters. You know, the guy who was the epidemiologist for the state of California for 20 years said to me that there has never been a geographical cluster that has been proven medically. I mean, Libby, Montana, obviously, is an exception to that. But it's really, really hard to, and even if you do show that there is an elevated incidence of a certain kind of cancer in a neighborhood, being able to establish that exposures from chemical emissions are the cause of it is, you know, is yet another hurdle that needs to be, you know, climbed. Yes.
Right.
So it's nearly impossible. And there's also the, you know, it should be pointed out that in this case, the oil industry has gone to great lengths over the years to suppress medical information. I mean, for example, there was a study that came out in 2004 by the National Cancer Institute showing that benzene exposure, even at levels below which our government says is safe, hurts people's blood. And the immediate response to that by the American petroleum industry was to put up, I can't remember how many millions of dollars, to refute the study. And that sort of has been the a pattern over the years. So it makes, and I saw that was also true in this litigation as well. It makes, you know, teasing out the facts very, very difficult. Yeah.
It's been the pattern with a lot of science and the petroleum industry. I think they're very good at paying people to suppress information or changing studies. I mean, the most famous example is Philip Cooney rewriting evidence of climate change for the administration, and then he goes and works for ExxonMobil after that.
Right.
Did writing this book and doing the research...
Well, he also had been a lawyer for the American Petroleum Institute when he went to the White House.
Which is a lobbying group for the petroleum industry for a long time. Did writing this book and doing the research, did it radicalize you in any way? Did it shock you? Did you go in thinking, oh, we'll be able to find this and go, I can't believe that we handle information about environmental toxins and health this way?
Did it radicalize me? I think I sort of went into it like Masheed Soleimani. I think I went into it thinking that the government agencies were doing what they should be doing in terms of protecting us. I mean, after all, you know, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency was created, you know, during the Nixon administration after the big oil spill up in Santa Barbara, and ostensibly could be doing some remarkable stuff in terms of, but given what's happened with the Bush administration in terms of, for example, enforcement actions relative to air pollution, that's been terribly disappointing. I hesitate to say that I've been radicalized, but I have been. I think my eyes have been opened in a way that they weren't when I started working on this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to open it up to questions in the audience, but I want you to elaborate on just one more quote from the book. The search for truth was not necessarily the same as the search for justice. I wondered about that, and I thought it was really interesting.
Well, because the search for justice is about, in this case anyway, it turned out was about watching 20 lawyers hired by the various oil companies, you know, top-notch defense lawyers from Latham & Watkins and from... Is anybody here from Latham & Watkins, by the way? They're in this building, I know. Anyway, they were doing a smash-up job, but it had nothing to do with ferreting out the truth of trying to figure out what the relationship actually was between all of these sick people and the possibility that these industrial facilities might have contributed to their illnesses. You know, the way that the law in the state of California is structured is that you have to show that the emissions were a substantial factor in causing the illnesses. And so there was, if anything, just it was a way of obfuscating the truth rather than, you know, digging into what was really going on, in my opinion.
Are there questions in the audience? Right here in the red. Oh, okay.
Thank you. I was interested in the number of oil wells that were mentioned in the Sunday article review of your book, and how many of them seem to be at Cedars-Sinai and at the Beverly Center, and whether they too might not pose an equivalent kind of hazard to those people who live in those areas.
Well, your question is a really, really good question. And trying to evaluate, you know, what the chemical exposures are that are coming off of the wells, they're right behind the Beverly Center.
Right.
And there's the sizable number. I can't remember how many, but it's a lot.
Like
and
18 or 19, something like that.
You know, I can't really answer. We have these agencies, for example, the Air Quality Management District, which is should be monitoring the air around these facilities. But the only way that you can get an inspector, I think there's something like 30,000 facilities that are supposedly inspected by 100 people. So getting people to respond to complaints, usually based on the fact that something smells bad, is very, very difficult. And as we saw in the Beverly Hills case, I mean, the air quality, because it was a school, the Air Quality Management District, and because it was such a sort of hot topic, it was in the press a lot, I think that they were embarrassed into going out there more than they ordinarily would. But it's not just, you know, it's not just the wells over there. I mean, they're the ones over, I think they're licensed to drill 50 wells over what used to be Occidental Petroleum, now is Brightburn on Olympic and Doheny, for example. And they're really right up against a residential area there, and there's a little nursery school just very close by.
AQMD years ago used to do an eyeball test.
Eyeball test?
Inspectors went out to places like Torrance. And if you had red eyeballs, then you knew the air was polluted. So.
And that's when the air was really much more noticeably bad in the Los Angeles Basin, right, where
but
your eyes burned.
You
interesting.
Your
back here.
Hi. I, too, am a Beverly graduate. My brother had Hodgkin's. He's 4 years in remission. I just wanted to say that I did buy your book, and it sounds like you're coming from the right place. The one thing I didn't think you emphasized enough, if you don't mind me saying that, is that those 19 oil wells, besides the one that's covered with the origami macrame garbage on Olympic.
Yeah.
The other 18 are under the athletic fields.
Right.
I wasn't sure if people here heard that. These children are playing on fields with oil wells that are leaking benzene gas under them. Thank you.
Well, there are some people who think that what's more important, in fact, than the chemical emissions coming out of these wells is the seepage of methane and the possibility of explosion from them, and that safety factor alone should be enough not to have. I mean, you could not build a new school next to a facility like this today. But there's a lot. I think that there's altogether, I think it's something like 278 wells underneath Beverly Hills.
We should point out that the origami tower that you referred to is actually, it's called the Tower of Hope, right?
And it's garbage.
You want to describe it just a little bit for the people who aren't familiar with it and who painted it?
There's a chapter in my book that talks a little bit about the history about the Tower of Hope. What had been a soundproofing panel around this derrick. In 2000, all of the children of the city of Beverly Hills and the west side of Los Angeles were doing community service project, which was very, very much the people in Beverly Hills took to heart because it was considered an art therapy project for children at the City of Hope and other pediatric cancer hospitals up and down the state of California, where they were brought panels to paint. And if they could not use their hands, they had special brushes that were attached to their feet. And people took great pride in the painting of this derrick, and that's why they called it the Tower of Hope. And there was a commemoration ceremony in June of 2000 for this art project. And what the Tower of Hope was doing was hiding a pollution scrubber inside, but we didn't find out about that until after the fact. But that's the Tower of Hope.
I was just going to ask you one more question. Do you know anything about that thing that used to be a field that was fenced off across from the high school between Century City Hospital and the SCE building?
You mean it's now a parking lot?
It's now a parking lot.
Yeah, well, that used to be... Gulf Oil had 25 wells operating there.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder until 1990, they supposedly abandoned the wells. The property's contaminated, and that's why there's no building. The only thing that they could put on there is a parking lot.
Right.
So there was operating up until 90. That was one of the drill sites. And then there's the drill site over by Olympic where the Tower of Hope is. And then there was also, when I was going to school, right at what was then the girls' field, there were these pump jacks that were on top of the field, and then they moved those out.
They did. I was there. I graduated in 81, and they had the oil wells on the south field, the girls' field, too.
Let's move on. We have a couple more. We have a lot of hands up. So there's a question in the back and another one down here.
Okay, thank you. First, I'd like to ask about how far back the significantly increased occurrence of cancer goes, and possibly related, do you cover in your book any possible relation between the natural emission of methane gas and the cancer increase?
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean, the possible emission of methane gas? You mean specifically from the wells themselves?
No.
Natural methane gas.
But the whole field from downtown to the west. Mm-hmm. In 1952, there was a very large earthquake that shifted things around and actually caused tar to come up seeping through the ground far to the west of the La Brea tar pits. Mm-hmm. And I had the idea that that might also have released the methane, which, of course, caused a problem later in the Fairfax area, and up in the San Fernando Valley has caused a problem near Poly High School, where some of the school had to be evacuated for part of a time because of that, and I think that had been an oil field. So I'd just like to know if you cover that in the book or what you think about that and how far back all of this goes.
I didn't cover that in the book. I mean, what I do cover in the book is methane. You know, the content of there's a small amount of benzene that's coming out of natural gas. But in terms of methane shifting relative to earthquakes, I absolutely did not cover that in the book. It's a really interesting theory, though. I don't really know much about it at all.
Mm-hmm. There's a question down here in the second row.
I'm wondering about what happened at Belmont High School right here in downtown L.A. And, I mean, they actually stopped building the school. In part, was it due to some of the research that you uncovered? Or was it, I mean, or did did the same sort of thing happen and it therefore caused them to shut it down where a school was going to be built on this, on these fields that were, you know, contaminated?
As I understand it, Belmont stopped for very political reasons, and partly because there was a discovery of an earthquake fault right underneath where the wells were. Bill Piazza's here. He could explain it to you. There's a guy here who's a wonderful guy who works for the Los Angeles Unified School District who knows all about the safety and assessment of, so you know about Belmont. Can you answer the question?
Thanks, Joy, I appreciate this.
Well, you're the expert.
I'm also in the book, though. Although I don't have a mullet, though, do I?
Not anymore.
Okay, I cut my hair a little bit. And I don't have cowboy boots, but let's see, just an aside. Methane gas, the biggest problem, one, politics was clearly involved. There was an issue associated with, did the district do enough in assessing it before it decided to build a school on that particular property? There was mitigation that was employed in terms of a liquid boot and something to mitigate any methane gas migration, the potential for exposure. That was done. The issue was, it wasn't done good enough, and I think that was a real problem. There were allegations of toxics. It wasn't a toxic issue. It was an explosive issue. And again, it was that I don't think the district at the time really did as good a job as it could have in really trying to mitigate the potential for explosion. But it wasn't when they decided to explore and go further and to develop the site after things have calmed down and we got a better idea of the type of methane and the type of generation rates that were under the site, they did discover an earthquake fault, and that had to make an adjustment, not to from a toxic or explosion issue. It was a matter of setback buildings away from the fault in a certain mm-hmm. distance that would appease the state architect. Mm-hmm. But it was an explosion issue. It wasn't a toxic issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We have time for one more. How about right back here?
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering if there was any discussion about relocating Beverly Hills High School.
Not by Beverly Hills High School, there's not. No, I mean, there's been no serious discussion of that I'm aware of. The only person who has mentioned that to me is Aaron Brockovich. And aside from that, I think that, no, in answer to the question. I don't know where it would be possible in the city of Beverly Hills to move the school. There was that property up on Sunset Boulevard that just got bought up. That might have been possible, I guess. Or maybe the Hawthorne School. But
wouldn't it be easier to just shut down the wells?
Technically the city has a lease agreement and the school district until 2016. So they would need to get out of the contract, and I don't know that that's possible. But I noticed that the lawyer for the city of Beverly Hills in the litigations here, Mr. Biscard, maybe he could answer that question.
If you give me the mic, I may go on all night. What is the question, Joy?
The question was about the moving of the school and the city and the possibility of the closing of the oil wells.
There has been in all due respect to Joy, no evidence, and I emphasize no evidence of a health risk at Beverly Hills High School.
Well, that's
I know
what
that,
you said in
I know
court, certainly.
That is what I did say in court, right. And that view did prevail. I think that there is no chance that Beverly Hills High School will be moved at any time, at least in our lifetimes.
Have you read the book, and are you going to read the book?
Yes, I did read the book, and the only thing I took real exception to, Joy, was your reference to me being portly.
Sorry. Right. Everybody hates how I describe them.
Everybody hates being described.
Yeah, except Masheed, who I said was beautiful. That was okay.
Well, I think we have to move on to the book signing. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.